A number of questions arise in the midst of a pandemic. Some of them are easier to answer than others, and some of them, if you let them burrow all the way down to the base of your brain, will keep you up all night. So many questions, questions about safety, about trust, about the future. How safe is it to go to the store, to the mall, or to a movie theater, or to eat in a restaurant? How safe is it to go to work or to school or to church? What authorities are we supposed to trust? How do we know the numbers are accurate? Are we sure our leaders are credible and competent and up to the task? And what do we do if they're not? How will the world be different? How will travel be different? How will business be different? How will church be different when life finally returns to something resembling normal? And will life ever return to something resembling normal? And just when will we get a vaccine that is both effective and safe? And what if it takes longer to get that vaccine than we currently anticipate? So many questions. And as people of faith, it's normal for us to have additional questions. Questions like, where is God in all of this? Or what is God up to in the midst of this? Or to put an even finer point on it, what is the connection between God and the coronavirus? Now, this is not an unreasonable question. It's not an outlandish question because there are several stories in the Old Testament especially that describe the occurrence of plagues and diseases and maladies of various sorts and somehow connect them to the will of God. God causes them or God allows them to happen. And we can use these stories in the Old Testament to approach and view the presence of the coronavirus in God's good world from several different perspectives. I really appreciate the work Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann has done by laying out and unpacking these different perspectives in the Old Testament in his recent book, Virus as a Summons to Faith. So much of what I'm about to say grows out of my reading of this book. So let's jump into it. The first perspective from which we can wonder about the presence of the coronavirus in God's good world is what I would call the Exodus perspective, or with apologies to Rick Warren, we could also call it the purpose-driven perspective. This is likely the most obvious perspective if you're familiar with the Old Testament, especially the Exodus story. Because what happens in the Exodus story? In the Exodus story, God sends plagues on the Egyptians for a specific purpose. And actually, God's purpose in the Exodus story is threefold. First, God sends the plagues on the Egyptians to make a name for himself among the nations while defeating the so-called Egyptian gods, including Pharaoh, who held himself up as a god, while also creating for himself a new people out of the Israelite slaves he's setting free. There was a specific purpose behind everything we read in the Exodus story. It's also worth noting that these plagues are delivered to the Egyptians with precision. There are no innocent Israelites accidentally taken down by a stray plague. There is no collateral damage. It's a precision strike, and it is driven by God's purpose in the story. The plagues in Egypt further God's purpose, God's plan, God's promise to bless the whole world through Abraham's descendants. And at the same time, it also allows God to humble an arrogant leader and take down an oppressive empire. And so from this perspective, it is possible for someone to wonder, is the coronavirus God's way of humbling arrogant leaders and politicians and taking down ungodly and oppressive regimes? Now, this is only one perspective from an ancient story that describes God's purpose in an ultra-specific way. Let's move on to the second perspective. The second perspective is what I'll call the exile or exilic perspective. I can also call this the quid pro quo perspective, but I'm not going to call it that very often because it's hard to say. This perspective explains why Israel is taken into exile by the Babylonians, because God is punishing God's people for their sins. They are getting what they deserve. God warned his people about this through Moses in Deuteronomy 28. In a long list of curses that Moses said will come upon the people if they don't keep God's law in the promised land, we read these words. Deuteronomy 28, beginning in verse 20. The Lord will send on you curses, confusion and rebuke in everything you put your hand to, until you are destroyed and come to sudden ruin because of the evil you have done in forsaking him. The Lord will plague you with diseases until he has destroyed you from the land you are entering to possess. The Lord will strike you with wasting disease, with fever and inflammation, with scorching heat and drought, with blight and mildew, which will plague you until you perish. Well, those are just a few of the curses listed in Deuteronomy 28, but they make the point. The plagues that come upon God's people in the promised land, the punishment that comes upon God's people is a result of their unfaithfulness to God, is a result of their sin, is a result of their idolatry. I'm also calling this the quid pro quo perspective because the notion that both the righteous and the wicked get what they deserve is a base note that rumbles through the Old Testament. For example, in the first Psalm, Psalm 1 verse 6, we read, "For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to destruction." There are two ways of life. The way of the righteous, that's the blessed way. The way of the wicked, that's the way of destruction. Down that path leads to cursing and curses. Seems so simple, black and white, cut and dry. And this perspective is the foundation of so much of ancient and contemporary conventional wisdom that says you get what you deserve. If you do good, you'll be blessed. If you do evil, you'll be punished. And if something bad happens to you, it's probably because you did something wrong and God is punishing you for it. You get what you deserve. And God uses plagues, diseases, and maladies to punish the guilty. And so from this perspective, it's possible for someone to wonder if the coronavirus is God's way of punishing guilty people for their sins. But who exactly is God punishing? And what are their sins? And how are we supposed to know? The third perspective is what I'll call the Job perspective. Could also call this the mysterious holiness of God perspective. I've saved this perspective for last, and I'm going to spend the most time on it because I believe it's the most helpful and relevant for our current situation. The story of Job directly counters and contradicts the quid pro quo perspective. Job is a righteous man, and he is afflicted with great suffering, including painful sores all over his body. And Job's friends believe that he's suffering because he's guilty. He's committed a sin, and God is punishing him for it. And they implore Job to repent of this secret sin. But Job resists. He insists that he's innocent. He insists that he has done nothing to deserve his afflictions. And he argues with his friends and also takes his case to God and demands an explanation for his suffering. And near the end of the book of Job, God shows up to answer Job out of a storm. And he asks Job a series of penetrating questions that expose the limits of Job's capacity, the limits of Job's comprehension of how God works in the world. And when God is done questioning Job, Job essentially says, I think I'll be quiet now. I'm in way over my head. I don't need an answer to my question. It's the mysterious holiness of God. But the story ends with God endorsing Job's righteousness. His suffering is not the result of his sin. But even so, the reason for Job's suffering is never revealed to him in the story. It remains a mystery to him. Now, one of the reasons the book of Job is in the Bible is to teach us to not be like Job's friends, glibly offering our limited insights into why the coronavirus is present in God's world. It's so easy to assume, it's so easy to assert. But Job says, not so fast. Our insight into God's activity, our understanding of the way God works in the world is limited. This is one of the reasons we say God is holy. His ways are not our ways, and his thoughts are not our thoughts. This doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to better understand God and the way God works in the world and the way God's world works. Of course we should, but it does mean we should approach the subject with some humility, deep humility. In my experience, the deeper we dig into the scriptures trying to understand God, the more questions about God our digging surfaces. God is far more mysterious to me now than when I first started preaching. And the book of Job reminds us that a holy, mysterious God will not be reduced or simplified or domesticated by theology or religion or sermons, or for that matter, science. I want to show you a chapter in the Old Testament that talks about the limits of science and the value of wisdom. I have been enchanted with this chapter ever since I heard a professor in college read it out loud to our class. We were intrigued by what it said, but he refused to tell us where it was found in the Bible. He said we had to go find out for ourselves. It turns out it was in Job 28. And Jessica Waugh is going to read it for us. It's a longer reading than usual, but I believe it's worth it. Please listen carefully. There may be a test afterwards.
There is a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Mortals put an end to the darkness. They search out the farthest recesses for ore in the blackest darkness. Far from human dwellings, they cut a shaft in places untouched by human feet. Far from other people, they dangle and sway. The earth, from which food comes, is transformed below as by fire. Lapis lazuli comes from its rocks, and its dust contains nuggets of gold. No bird of prey knows that hidden path. No falcon's eye has seen it. Proud beasts do not set foot on it, and no lion prowls there. People assault the flinty rock with their hands and lay bare the roots of the mountains. They tunnel through the rock. Their eyes see all its treasures. They search the sources of the rivers and bring hidden things to light. But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? No mortal comprehends its worth. It cannot be found in the land of the living. The deep says, "It is not in me." The sea says, "It is not with me." It cannot be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed out in silver. It cannot be bought with the gold of Ophir, with precious onyx or lapis lazuli. Neither gold nor crystal can compare with it, nor can it be had for jewels of gold. Coral and jasper are not worthy of mention. The price of wisdom is beyond rubies. The topaz of Kush cannot compare with it. It cannot be bought with pure gold. Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds in the sky. Destruction and death say, "Only a rumor of it has reached our ears." God understands the way to it, and he alone knows where it dwells, for he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when he made a decree for the rain and a path for the thunderstorm, then he looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and tested it. And he said to the human race, "The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to shun evil is understanding."
In the first part of that chapter, there is a description of what we might call an ancient version of science. There is mining, there is exploration of God's world for valuable and useful treasure. It is well within humanity's capacity and calling to seek and to find and to better understand and to use for our benefit the treasures and the secrets we find in God's world. But there are limits to science. The deeper we dig into God's creation in search for answers to questions like, how does God's world work? And why does God's world work this way? The deeper we dig, the more questions our digging surfaces about creation and the God above it. There are limits to science. The second part of the chapter speaks to those limits. It explains how there are some hidden treasures that only God can reveal. Treasures like wisdom. True wisdom cannot be found through scientific exploration any more than it can be found through theological speculation. No, true wisdom comes from the fear of the Lord. That is to say, living in awe and wonder of the mysterious holiness of God. True wisdom comes from the fear of the Lord and shunning evil. Proverbs 25:2 says, "It is the glory of God to conceal things, But the glory of kings is to search things out. It's within God's nature to conceal, to hide. And it's within human nature to seek and to often find. But one of the lessons we can learn from our diligent exploration of God's world using the scientific method and asking scientific questions is that a holy God can conceal more than we can ever hope to find. The deeper we dig for answers, the more we realize we don't know. And so perhaps the coronavirus has brought us to a place of awesome and terrible wonder. We've come to realize how vulnerable we are. We realize how little control we actually have over so much of what goes on in our lives. We realize how contingent our existence is on something outside of creation, that something being God. We've come to this place of wonder where we wonder, what is God up to in all of this? Or why has God caused, or if not caused, why has God allowed this to happen in our world? And in response, we are confronted with a mystery. The mystery of a holy God who can do whatever a holy God wants to do and not have to explain himself, the message of Job. We are confronted with the mystery of a God who can conceal far more than we can ever hope to find. And when we come to this place of wonder and we realize that some hidden treasures, some hidden secrets, some hidden things are forever beyond our grasp, beyond our comprehension, we find the Lord. Or better yet, we fear the Lord, which then allows us to receive a kind of wisdom from God that we can never attain for ourselves. And may God give us this wisdom. May God give us the wisdom we desperately need right now. May God give us a kind of wisdom that will see us through the adversity and the uncertainty and the unanswerable questions we're currently facing. May your heart and your mind and your soul be filled with the wisdom that can only come from a holy and mysterious God. Next week, Lord willing, we'll explore how Jesus fleshes out, I mean literally fleshes out, the mystery of God in our strange and perplexing world. I'll see you next time.